these rituals? You know, there's a very famous question, and Maimonides addresses this question, and that is, Abraham didn't need the Torah to reach God. And so therefore, why do we need the Torah to reach God? If Abraham could do it, why can't we do it? Abraham discovered God on his own. Abraham was the son of an idol worshipper. Not only was the son of an idol worshipper, he was the son of the manufacturer of idols. Terach was apparently a manufacturer of idols. So if Abraham, coming from his background, could discover God, why do we need a system? Why do we need the Torah to become spiritual? Why can't we be like Abraham? So Maimonides has this question, and he discusses the greatness of Abraham, how he reached God through the intellect, through searching, looking for meaning, asking questions where the world came from. And it seems as if it's true, anyone can reach God, can come to this conclusion of God, if they, like Abraham, really search truthfully. So therefore we're stuck with this question. So why do we need the Torah? And it seems from Rambam, totally against the Midrashim, which say that the Torah pre-existed creation and God looked into the Torah and created the world, Rambam says that ideally man should not need the Torah. Ideally there's a state where any man, Abraham was not even Jewish, any human being can come to this realization of God without a Torah. So why do we need the Torah? So he says that you're right, any being can come to this realization. But how many people do come to this realization by themselves? And so therefore we see this in Jewish history, early Jewish history. The Jews were a little tribe, sons of Jacob. 70 Jews go into Egypt. They weren't even Jews, they were Israelites. They go into Egypt and eventually they become this massive people, and eventually their identity starts getting lost. From being the sons of Jacob, now the great-great-great-grandsons, the identity starts getting lost. So what happens? They start adopting the culture of the society around them. It was very, very hard to tell the difference between the Jews and the Egyptians. And eventually they assimilate into Egyptian culture. And what happens is they start forgetting who they are. So Rambam says God saw that the ideals of Abraham could not survive without a system. Because Abraham had these great ideals, ethical monotheism. I believe in one God, and I believe you have to be a good person, you have to be a righteous person, you have to be an upright person. But how do you translate that into action? They're very fine ideals, beautiful ideals. They're very, very good to talk, you know. You look at our president, he has great talk. He's a great talker. It's a great, beautiful talk. Ideals are very fine, but how do you translate these ideals into concrete action? And the second thing is, how do you keep these ideals alive? How does a person keep these ideals alive? How does a person pass these ideals down to the next generation? So Abraham was successful up to a point, passed it down to his son, one of his sons. Isaac was successful up to a point, 50% success rate. He passed it out to one son. Jacob was totally successful up to a point. A lot of troubles on the way. Sons turning against other sons with all the ethics and the morals he tried to teach them. We see that the system nearly fell apart, but it was successful eventually, and they all received, thank God Joseph wasn't killed, and they could do teshuvah for that, and they could repent, and they could come back and continue the traditions. But the great-grandchildren of Jacob started falling apart. The whole system started falling apart because there was no system. All they had was a loose set of beliefs transmitted to them by their forefathers. And a loose set of beliefs is like any other culture where you have a very loose set of beliefs just transmitted. What happens is, after a while, if you play the game telephone, you'll know that you just pass down one word down a chain, like the oral law, and eventually it starts getting distorted. So the message of the grandfathers started getting distorted. The message of Abraham started getting distorted. The ideals were being lost. So Rambam, Maimonides says, God saw this, and God said, I have to give these people a system. But ideally, the ideal, what is the ideal? The ideal is man should come to God without a system. But again, it's very hard to be a genius like Einstein and say, you know what, I'm going to be a nuclear physicist without going to school. Because that's what we're talking about. We're talking about discovering God without going through those steps, which a person needs to go through. There's, without a system, a person has to have be a spiritual genius. So what the, God did is He gave us a system, which is the Torah, of becoming spiritual step by step. A step-by-step system, which will hopefully inculcate a person with spirituality. And it's even hard. It's hard even with the system. Forget about without the system. Sometimes it's harder with the system because you get caught up in the system and you forget about what the aims of the system is. And there's many Jews today, unfortunately, on both sides of this equation. There's many Jews today have lost any ideals of what Judaism is all about. Unfortunately, I don't want to give any examples, but one comes to mind straight away. Young girl, unfortunately, Monica, what can we do? Jewish girl who lost the total ideals of Judaism, are lost. Grew up in a rich, spoiled brat environment, and anything goes. Just have a bit of fun. And power, and this, and that. It's all, unfortunately, the ideals of Judaism are lost. On the other hand, we have a small minority of Orthodox Jews as well, who cannot see the forest for the trees. They concentrate and focus on the system, but they forget what the system is getting to. And that's the dangers on both sides of the coin. But what is worse? We have to question ourselves, is what is worse? God decided that it's much worse for there to be no system at all. If there was no system, the chances of being Abraham, how many generations did God have to wait for one Abraham? He waited 10 generations from Adam to Noah. And he waited 10 generations from Noah to Abraham. 20 generations went by, one Abraham. One spiritual genius who had come back and rediscovered God. So God says, you know what? I'm not going to wait around for these spiritual geniuses. It's like closing down all the colleges and saying, you know what? We're going to wait for Einsteins to come along. Okay, there'll be one or two Isaac Newtons. The apple will bounce on his head and he'll go, oh, yeah, gravity, yes, I can discover that. Without a system, and that's why today technology is really caught on. Why? Because there's a system today. There was no system for technology. There were no colleges. The places for adult education were limited. Today there's colleges and there's research centers. Obviously, it's going to catch on. And that's really what the whole idea of the Torah was, to provide a system for goodness. It's a system for goodness, it's a system for ethics, a system for morals, and it's a system for trying to reach God. That's really what the bottom line of the whole Torah is. And unfortunately, you talk about rituals, red lights go on in people's minds. Rituals, what does ritual mean? What does a ritual mean? It's scary. Rituals means obligations and obligations. The person gets lost in the obligations and they forget what the obligations they're trying to get to. There's a very famous midrash, which sounds like a very reform midrash. It's a very reform midrash, but it was said by one of the greatest rabbis, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. Rabbi Judah the Prince, who is the author, the editor of the Mishnah. And he says, and we're talking about kashrut. We were talking about kashrut the last few weeks. So I want to tie it in with, because we might get lost into the kashrut and might forget what the bigger picture is. What is the broader picture? What is kashrut trying to get us to? So Rabbi Judah the Prince has this beautiful midrash. And the midrash says that Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi asked this question. Does God really care how we slaughter the animal? Okay, it's got to be painless and it's got to be quick. But does God really care every minute detail of the slaughter, of how we slaughter, all the different laws of slaughtering? God really care. So he said, the bottom line is, God wants us to be good, ethical people. What is he saying? Obviously, he's the one writing down all these laws. So obviously, he's saying that God does care. But what is he saying? This is the broad picture. Don't lose sight of the big picture. The big picture is, the bottom line is, if I keep kosher, I keep Shabbat, I keep all the rituals, but I'm a lousy person, then I've forgotten what the message is. I've forgotten where I am going. I've forgotten what the goal is. It's like the guy training. The guy training for soccer. I'm sorry, I don't play any other games. I'm brought up in England, soccer and cricket. That's all we play over there. A bit of tennis. But it's a guy growing up and he's practicing the soccer. And what happens? He forgets which way his goal is. So he's the greatest soccer player in the world, but he's kicking it back into his own goal. That's a goalie's nightmare. You know, one of your own players. And that's one of the problems in Judaism is we have all these laws, we know all the games, we forget, what is the goal? Which goal am I trying to get into? And that's one of the dangers. You know the system, but you forget what the purpose of the system is. It's like law. I can be the greatest lawyer, We have lawyers in the White House. You can know all the law, you know the whole system, forget what the bottom line of the system is. What is the bottom line of the system? What are all these laws for? All these laws are for trying to improve society, trying to make society a better place, hopefully. That's the bottom line of all these laws. The same thing with Jewish law. Bottom line of Jewish law is ethics, morals, and closeness to God. The three bottom lines is, and through that will come perfection of the world. But those are really the bottom line of Jewish law. So we talk about rituals, we mustn't forget what these rituals are trying to do. So what are the rituals trying to do? How do the rituals bring us closer to God? That's the question we have to ask is, how does a ritual make me more ethical? I mean, I can keep kosher and I may be the biggest crook. How does a ritual meant to make me kosher, meant to make me not just kosher in what I eat, but a kosher person, a better person? How does a ritual meant to improve a person? To try and explain this a bit, we have the story in the Torah about Cain and Abel. It's a very interesting story. It's a very strange story. Because here we have right at the beginning of a holy book. And the first thing the Torah seems to discuss is, number one, Adam and Eve were thrown out of the garden. I mean, we have to understand what's going on over there. The Bible starts off with people falling. Falling, not just falling, but falling into an abyss. We're talking about falling from tremendous heights into the depths of depravity. Depravity, murder is one of the worst things a person can do. We're talking about Cain and Abel. Cain killing his brother, which is a very hard thing to do. Some Midrashim try and soften the impact of that. They say, you know what? Cain didn't mean to kill his brother. Cain just wanted to give him a good beating. No one ever killed anyone before. He took a stone and wanted to beat him. I mean, that's our reaction, right? Person gets angry. What's the first reaction is? Before a person learns how to control themselves, violence, beat, abuse. That's the first thing. Cain wanted to abuse Abel. He just went too far. He didn't realize he's going to kill him. That's how the Midrash tries to soften the blow of Cain and Abel. Really, it's a very hard thing to do. But who is Cain? What is the personality of Cain? And we have to realize that we are descendants of... Well, actually, we're descendants of Cain and the third son, Seth. But we have to understand that we have the genes of Cain in us. Abel, the good guy, is dead. And this is true in history. If you look at history, who survived in history? It wasn't the poor innocent guys who were killed. We are all descendants of conquerors. All of us here. We are descendants of this, because survival of the fittest, as history, till the Jews came along and started preaching, look after the poor and don't tread on the innocent and this and that and the other. The survivors of history are usually the people in power. And you see this, go to third world countries. Who are the people who survive? Whose kids are not dying of starvation? They're the ones on top, usually, not the ones on the bottom. So who are the survivors today on this planet? Usually are, if we go back in time, that'd be surprising. Can you imagine? We could go back and research and see our forefathers. I wonder what we'd see. I don't know if it would be such a good sight. But if you take this analogy going backwards, most of the world today are survivors because their great-grandparents were the victors. Their great-grandparents put the other people down under their feet, trampled on the other people. And that's how they survived. That's the majority, probably. Anyway, go back to Cain. Cain was the murderer. The murderer survived, and the murdered obviously doesn't. The innocent guy, the pure guy, gets killed. The person who survives is the murderer. The murderer survived. And that was Cain. But who is Cain? And we're all descended from Cain. So who is Cain? Cain was not just a murderer. Cain was a very creative being. Cain was another Abraham in a way. Cain was the first person to come along and invent service of God. Cain had this brainwave, I'm going to bring a sacrifice to God. Cain, the murderer Cain, came along with this concept. It wasn't Abel who invented this concept. Cain was the one who invented this concept. Who was Cain? We find the descendants of Cain were tillers of the soil, the inventors of the plow. They were the musicians, the inventors of musical instruments. If you look at Lamech, who was the grandson of Cain, and you see his descendants, Tubal-Cain, the inventor of musical instruments, the inventor of plows, the inventor of utensils, and all kinds of machinery. Who are these people? Cain. The descendants of Cain were geniuses, inventive geniuses, creative geniuses. One of the dangers of creation is, and this is El Alamo, one of the geniuses of creation is you can create a monster as well. You can create Frankenstein. If you don't create, nothing gets done. Okay, you don't create. You don't create good, you don't create bad. You don't create anything. Status quo. You start creating, you start upsetting the status quo. That's why today we need medical ethics. Why medicine is so advanced. Genetic engineering now. The ethics has to catch up. Otherwise, who knows what we've created. That was Cain. Cain was the creator. Cain was the genius who could do things, could invent things. And this genius of invention had to be curbed. A Cain needs laws. Abel doesn't need laws, because Abel doesn't do anything. Abel just follows example. Abel doesn't do anything. Cain needs guidelines. Look at the Nazis. Here you have the most advanced civilization. Germany at that time, 1930s, was, if you wanted to get a degree, the best place to get a degree in those days was Germany. You go to Berlin, University of Berlin, the top scientists, top physicists, top mathematicians, University of Berlin, and the peak of power. That was Cain. Why? If you unleash that energy from ethics and morals, you get Frankenstein. That's what we got. We got a Frankenstein. And that's why Cain needs these laws more than anyone else. These rules and regulations. We as the descendants of Cain need rules and regulations. Otherwise, what's going to happen is our inventiveness is going to drive us berserk. Our inventiveness, the thing which is so good, which today, you know, we praise entrepreneurs, right? We praise being an entrepreneur. You can be an entrepreneur for good, you can be an entrepreneur for bad. But it's not an entrepreneur, it just sits back, nothing, doesn't do anything. So we're praising this, we have to keep check of it. Same thing with capitalism. Capitalism is good, but once you start paying them minimum wages or whatever it is, below minimum wages, that's what they're talking about, third world countries, and paying them, what is it, 14 cents an hour, I think, in China. So Nike, they're talking about Nike, right? Someone came back and said, hey, 1 second, put this in perspective. It costs 14 cents to have a haircut in China. So it's not so bad. It's not such a bad. It's like today. Minimum wages are $5.50 or whatever. What is it today? Five something. And a haircut is about $7 for a man. So it's not so bad. I mean, Nike is on the mark, you know, if you compare it to a haircut. How much? But that's the dangers of Cain. Dangers of inventing. The dangers of being an entrepreneur is the dangers of Cain. Cain needs a system. The descendants of Cain needs a system. Productivity of Cain and the creativeness of Cain needs a system. The greatest challenge to mankind is, how does the creative person keep his powers in check and under control? And that's really what Torah and Jewish life tries to do. We have these guidelines of checks and balances. We try and teach a child from a very early age how to control. And you know how it is to control? Let me give you an example. My mother just came to visit me. I'm trying to do the fifth commandment. And you know how hard it is? It's terrific. It's so hard. It's a very hard commandment to do. I mean, they're far away. The parents are far away. It's very easy to do. You call them up on the phone once a week and say, hi, how are you doing? How's everything? Blah, 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 and it's over. But when they're right next to you and they say, I need a glass of water. Oh, no. I gotta go. How hot? What temperature is it now? I've got to go to water the thermostat. What time is it now? You got to go and see. What do you do? It's every second. It's like, what do you do? So it takes adjustment. And a person's got to be trained. It's like being in the army. You're trained to follow laws and discipline. Without this training, the army would fall apart. And the same thing is, we as human beings would fall apart. You know, today I've seen so many people, unfortunately, I talked about it before, with mental illnesses. There's so many Jews today with mental illness. No, I don't know about Gentiles, but I come in contact more with the Jewish population. I see so many people. There's a blessing in the Amidah, the fourth blessing. It's the first petition. Amidah is a sandwich, three introductory blessings, three end blessings, and the fourth blessing is, the first blessing we pray for, the petition is for brains. It's not just for brains. When we talk about brains, we talk about, we want to be geniuses, we want to be great in our brains, but there's other levels as well. When we talk about brains, we also mean health in the brains. Health of the mind is so important. And one of the things which can cause these problems is lack of a system, lack of guidance. People just going with the flow. What should I do today? I don't know what I'm going to do today. I have no structure in my life. A human being needs structure to be mentally healthy. A human being needs a sense of purpose to be mentally healthy. A human being needs a mission in life to be healthy mentally. Without these things, person, unfortunately, can become a drug addict very easily. And a person can, unfortunately, commit suicide. A person can be in depression, unfortunately, today. So many people are taking Prozac. Why? Because, number one, there's no guidance. Number two, there is no system. There's no structure in their lives. And number three, there's no sense of mission and purpose. So we need those three things. And again, the Bible comes in and gives us those three things. It gives you structure. You do this, this is good, and this is bad. This is good, this is bad. And a child, it's important. It's interesting to see how children just lap it up. You tell a child from day one, this is good, this is bad. The child is looking for it. The child doesn't want to grow up with a relative feel. Can I do this or not? Well, it's up to you, dear. It's up to me. I don't know what to do with this. What do I do with this? So let me experiment. It's up to me. I'm going to experiment. If you tell a child from day one, there's good in the world and there's bad in the world, then there's no experimentation. The child needs these rules. He's not equipped to be able to investigate from day one and come along with his own conclusions. How many people today bring up their children with no religion? And they say, you know what, my child will grow up. I'll open all the doors for them and let the child, you know, choose. And you see what the child's going to choose. The child doesn't even think about it past the age of four. Is there a God? No God. I made my mind up. That's it. When I'm 20, I'm not going to talk about it. I'm having fun chasing the girls. I'm not going to think about, is there a God or not God? I'm not going to bother about it. Most people are not going to even bother about it. And that was the society of Abraham. There were no rules. There was no guidance. There was no code. There was nothing. You had the seven Noahide laws, which died out with Noah, probably. And that's all you had. And that was the society of Abraham. Abraham, it says, thought out his own structure. Midrash says Abraham kept the whole Torah. What does that mean? Obviously, you can't take that literally. What does that mean is Abraham knew the purpose of the Torah. From day one, he knew the purpose of the Torah. The purpose of the Torah was be good, be moral, be ethical. So he kept the Torah. How do you keep the Torah? He kept the Torah without keeping the rituals. He kept the whole idea of the Torah without doing anything. He was closer to God than us. Even though we have the Torah, Abraham was on a much higher level. So how do we become Abrahams? And the answer is today, we can't become Abrahams without a system. We need that system. We need the stepping stones. And the rituals are the stepping stones. How are rituals stepping stones? And that's the question. The topic of today is, what are the rituals for? How are the rituals stepping stones? And we said, number one is structure, discipline. A ritual teaches a person discipline. Let's go back to a child. A child grows up, 4 years old, comes down early in the morning, and he comes down hungry. Sorry, first thing you have to do is wash your hands. Let's say a blessing on the washing hands. Second thing you have to do is pray, and then you get your breakfast. What's going on over here? What is this? Child abuse. Today, you consider it child abuse. But what we are teaching the child, in essence, is curb your desires, and there's a higher purpose. Before you can even get to satisfy your desires, there's a higher mission you have to do. You have to, first of all, you have to say, please. My sister-in-law puts it very nicely. When a child comes to her and says, I want this, Mom. She says, those who want do not get. Very simple. So, oh, please, can I have it? Okay, you can have it. But if you want it, you're not going to get it. And that's really what Judaism is all about. I want this. We want it. We don't encourage strong desires in Judaism. Anything we want is tightly controlled. Now, what's interesting is we don't say you can't have it. We say you can have it, but in certain quantities at a certain times, which is much harder than not having it at all. It's much easier to say, be celibate. When we tell you a guy, be celibate, or you can't be celibate, but you can't have it whenever you want either. That's much harder because then it's confusing. Either all or nothing. Most people today say all or nothing. No. Well, drip irrigation. It's called drip irrigation. You can take some, and that's the most effective kind of irrigation. Interesting. What is the most effective kind of irrigation is drip irrigation. Little drops here, little drops there. That's what goes in. And that's the Torah concept of this world. This world is little drops. The physical should be like a guy on the drip. You give a guy a bit of physical material things, drip irrigation. You had a bit of material, now a bit of spiritual, bit of material, bit of spiritual, physical, spiritual, spiritual. That's how a day is basically made up, is you pray in the morning, you have breakfast, again you got to say a blessing after the food, and then you got to go to work, and then you pray mincha, and then you go back to food, and then you eat every kind of mazon, you come back to work, and then you go back home, and then at home you got an evening service, and then you got to go to class, and by that time you got drip irrigation. You got a bit of physical, a bit of spiritual all mixed up.
which should tune a person to two things. One is to the physical world. Hopefully a person will not be carried away. We need the physical. We have to survive. One of the most important laws in the Torah is survival. And the first thing we have to do is, number one priority is survive. You know, it's a beautiful story. I don't think it's a true story. But there's one rabbi in, I think it's a Hasidic story. He wanted to know who his neighbor in the world to come is going to be. So he got his message, so-and-so is going to be a neighbor. So he looked at him up. He goes, he sees, big, fat, heavy guy. Trying to find out, what good does he have? So he sees and he's eating. When he eats, he just swallows the food. Just, I don't see any good thing in this person. Why is he going to be my neighbor in the world to come? So he asks him, he says, tell me, he says, why do you eat so much? He says, listen, he says, when I was a little kid, in front of my very eyes, the Cossacks came and killed my father. And my father died just like that. He said, I want to make sure if they come for me, it's not going to be so easy for them. So when he ate to survive. Basically, that's the idea is, number one, the first mission of a Jew is, it's a mitzvah to survive. Just by staying alive, every second we stay alive, we're doing a mitzvah. Because the Torah says, v'chai b'hem. You will live by the mitzvah. You will not die by the mitzvah. It's very important to, just survival itself is a big mitzvah. Every second we survive, that's a big mitzvah. It's a mitzvah on a Jew to look after their health, which, again, is lost in this totality of the picture of the rituals, and then you forget the mission of surviving. It's a mitzvah to survive. Why? Because if you don't survive, you can't pass on the message. Very simple. We have a message to pass on. We have a message to, we have a life to fulfill. Without life, there's nothing to fulfill. So the first mission is, number one, survival. Survival is very important. So the physical is very important. But secondly is, physical without the spiritual, the physical is important. We have to survive. But what for? If it's just survival for the sake of survival, then it doesn't really mean anything. It loses meaning. Life loses meaning. But if it's survival for the sake of transmitting a message, for the sake of improving, for the sake of self-fulfilling, then survival has a purpose. So there's two parts to it, and the problem is, a person can get so caught up in the survival, like today. They work out. They go to the gym every night, and it becomes like a religion. Why survival? I want to make sure I live till 85 or 90, fit as a fiddle, and that's it. I go for tan, and I go to the gym, and I go this. Survival becomes a mitzvah. But if that's the only thing, that's not enough. The next step is the spiritual. And that's why we need a system. The system is to make sure, to ensure that we have balance in life. How do you have balance between the physical and the spiritual? The Torah gives us guidelines. Without these guidelines, it's very hard for a person, like fiddler on the roof. We are fiddlers on the roof. We're really on the wire. We're all trapeze artists. We're trying to balance. Everything in life is trying to balance. The good I do here with the bad I'm going to do, the effects of what I do. It's such a hard decision. Decisions we make sometimes are hard. Because at first view, it might look good. And then on the second view, it might look bad. I mean, we have to really struggle with these decisions. Who knows what the outcome of certain decisions we make, which are very important decisions. And we may think we're doing the right thing, but eventually it takes a person with far-sightedness to be able to see not just the decision right now, what it's going to do to me now, but also the after-effects of the decision. And I'm not going to go into details. We can all figure out details of what things which are on our mind, what we're pondering, what decisions we have to make. But we need a system to try and guide us in this labyrinth of life. That's the Mesilat Yesharim compares this world to, you know, in those days the kings used to amuse themselves. They never had TV. They never had Hollywood. Well, how do they amuse themselves? Imagine a world without Hollywood. Come on, how does a person amuse themselves? There was no internet. What do you do in this spare time? So the kings came up with this invention, the maze. What they did is, if you go outside Versailles and you go outside Hampton Court in England, you'll see the kings and queens had this maze in their backyard. Hedges made into a maze. And they would take unfortunate victims, friends. They wouldn't be their friends after that, but they took their friends. They blindfolded them, led them through the middle of the maze, and left them there. And they said, now count to 10, and then 10, open your blindfold. They went out, they knew the way out, and they went up into the palace, and they could watch and see the fun. And they spent the afternoon just looking how their friends are lost in the maze, and trying to get out here, there, and they would laugh. It's so funny, my friend is lost in the maze. Silat Yisharim says, we are here. We are lost in this maze. and there aren't any signposts. Imagine being lost. In the darkness of this world, a child is born into this world, he's got to make his way through, trying to reach the other end. Trying to reach the way outside this maze. Where's the outside of the maze? Go to the world to come. That's outside the maze. We're trying to reach the world to come. We just don't know any directions. So what are these directions? So he says the Torah is the directions. The mitzvah to do is a small direction. It's the next step. I have a mitzvah to do. That's my next step. But the big plan is the Torah. The overview. You want to see what to do. Where to go in your life. You have to see the whole picture. Because that's the way out of the maze. So that's the verse in the psalm says, Ner mitzvah b'torah or. A mitzvah is like a candle. It just shows you one step ahead. By the mitzvah. You will not die by the mitzvah. It's very important to... Just survival itself is a big mitzvah. Every second we survive, that's a big mitzvah. It's a mitzvah on a Jew to look after their health, which, again, is lost in this totality of the picture of the rituals, and then you forget the mission of surviving. It's a mitzvah to survive. Why? Because if you don't survive, you can't pass on the message. Very simple. We have a message to pass on. We have a message to... We have a life to fulfill. Without life, there's nothing to fulfill. So the first mission is, number one, survival. Survival is very important. So the physical is very important. But secondly is, physical without the spiritual, the physical is important. We have to survive. But what for? If it's just survival for the sake of survival, then it doesn't really mean anything. It loses meaning. Life loses meaning. But if it's survival for the sake of transmitting a message, for the sake of improving, for the sake of self-fulfilling, then survival has a purpose. So there's two parts to it, and the problem is, person can get so caught up in the survival, like today. They work out. You go to the gym every night, and it becomes like a religion. Why survival? I want to make sure I live till 85 or 90, fit as a fiddle, and that's it. I go for a tan, and I go to the gym, and I go there. Survival becomes a mitzvah. But if that's the only thing, that's not enough. The next step is the spiritual, and that's why we need a system. The system is to ensure that we have balance in life. How do you have balance between the physical and the spiritual? The Torah gives us guidelines. Without these guidelines, it's very hard for a person, like fiddler on the roof. We are fiddlers on the roof. We are really on the wire. We're all trapeze artists. We're trying to balance. Everything in life is trying to balance. The good I do here with the bad I'm going to do, the effects of what I do. It's such a hard decision. Decisions we make sometimes are hard. Because at first view, it might look good. And then on the second view, it might look bad. I mean, we have to really struggle with these decisions. Who knows what the outcome of certain decisions we make, which are very important decisions. And we may think we're doing the right thing, but eventually it takes a person with far-sightedness to be able to see not just the decision right now, what it's going to do to me now, but also the after effects of the decision. And I'm not going to go into details. We can all figure out details of what things which are on our mind, what we're pondering, what decisions we have to make. But we need a system to try and guide us in this labyrinth of life. That's the Mesilat Yesharim compares this world to, you know, in those days the kings used to amuse themselves. They never had TV. They never had Hollywood. Well, how they amuse themselves? Imagine a world without Hollywood. Come on, how does a person amuse themselves? There was no internet. What do you do in this spare time? So the kings came up with this invention, the maze. What they did is, if you go outside Versailles and you go outside Hampton Court in England, you'll see the kings and queens had this maze in their backyard. Hedges made into a maze. And they would take unfortunate victims, friends. They wouldn't be their friends after that, but they took their friends. They blindfolded them, led them through the middle of the maze, and left them there. And they said, now count to 10, and then 10, open your blindfold. They went out, they knew the way out, and they went up into the palace, and they could watch and see the fun. And they spent the afternoon just looking how their friends are lost in the maze, trying to get out here, there, and they would laugh. It's so funny. My friend is lost in the maze. Mesilat Yesharim says, we are here. We are lost in this maze, and there aren't any signposts. Imagine being lost. In the darkness of this world, a child is born into this world. He's got to make his way through, trying to reach the other end. Trying to reach the way outside this maze. Where's the outside of the maze? Go to the world to come. That's outside the maze. We're trying to reach the world to come. We just don't know any directions. So what are these directions? So he says the Torah is the directions. The mitzvah to do is a small direction. It's the next step. I have a mitzvah to do, that's my next step. But the big plan is the Torah. The overview. You want to see what to do, where to go in your life, you have to see the whole picture. Because that's the way out of the maze. So that's the verse in the Psalm says, Ner mitzvah b'Torah or. A mitzvah is like a candle. It just shows you one step ahead. I know now I have another mitzvah to do. Okay, it's Hanukkah, so I've got a mitzvah to light the candles. That's just one step. What about tomorrow? Okay, it's Hanukkah tomorrow as well. What about after Hanukkah? Don't know. It's just one step. A mitzvah is just one step ahead. But a Torah or the Torah gives you light over the whole picture. It's a plan. It's a plan of action for a person's whole life. And so that's really bottom line. The bottom line of this whole idea is that the Torah is a system. It's a total system to try and inculcate to get a person to the next stage. And it's a balance between this world, between the physical and the spiritual. And we see this in the vision of Jacob, Jacob's ladder. Jacob's ladder is, it says he saw a ladder based on the ground, which is the physical, with its head in the heavens. That's really the balance in our lives. We're trying to get is, we have to be based in the ground, we have to be physical, we have to know that we need the material, we do need the material, but if that's all we do, then we forget. Our heads are not in the heavens. Our heads should be in the heavens. We should be guiding ourselves, pushing ourselves upward through materialism, and not downwards into more materialism, sinking into the materialism. That's one of the dangers of today's society. On the one hand, we're very, very fortunate. We have so much materialism over here. We're very, very fortunate. On the other hand, the biggest danger is sinking into it, getting caught up into it. And that's where we see the Torah, the Talmud sums it up. Perkei Avot sums it up. It's a beautiful line. It says, "Im ein kemach ein Torah." If there is no flour, you cannot learn Torah. There's no food on the table, you cannot become spiritual. That's why Judaism never viewed poverty in a favorable light. It's interesting. Jews never viewed poverty in a favorable light. So the pauper cannot be perfect spiritually. Why? They have no time for the spiritual. He's too busy putting food on the table. There's no time for the spiritual. And that's why they always looked for wealth. Wealth was always something good. But on the other hand, it says, Emen Torah en kemach. If there's no Torah study, if there's no spiritual purpose, you can have all the kemach, you can have all the flour in the world. But that flour is worth zero. It's not getting a person anywhere. So same thing, that's what they're saying is, life is here for a purpose. Life is important. Kemach, flour is very important. But flour without the purpose is not important. That's so many people today feel that today. They know that. Instinctively they know that. I have no purpose in the world. My life is not worth living. What is the purpose? Purpose is there is a purpose. People today unfortunately lose the sight of the purpose. And it's an exciting kind of purpose. And that's why I'm not in any great rush for the Messianic era. I find this life very entertaining. This life is fascinating and it's a big challenge. It's a big challenge to do it yourself without Big Daddy watching over your shoulder. I find that fascinating, and that's obviously there's other reasons why I want the Messianic era, but it's more fascinating to achieve things on your own. So we need this. We need this. We need the system to keep us back linked to what is the world all about. What does God want from us? Is there a God? How do I know there's a God? So we have a system to be able to inculcate this into our lives at every second of the day. We find that, there's this famous story. It's a bit of a chauvinistic story. But a man went to heaven. And he sees two lines of men. One is a massive line with thousands of men. The other one is a small little man. Just one man in front. So the angel tells him, he says, go to the long line. He said, why? He says, what two lines? He said, that's the line, the men who followed their wives' instructions. And this line is only for men who wives follow their instructions. So what are you doing here? He says, you don't look like the kind of guy who can tell your wife what to do. So what he says, my wife told me to sit here. So that's the bottom line is, a lot of people just do things by rote. Why are you doing this mitzvah? My wife told me to do it, that's why. Why are you doing this commandment? I don't know, my father used to do it, so I'm doing it, I'm continuing. So that is obviously not getting the person anywhere. It's good because the system is intact. But the system is meant to achieve a purpose. And the person cannot achieve the purpose because he doesn't know what it's bringing the person to. He's just doing everything by rote. That's the dangers of habit. So basically, what are the ideas of the mitzvot? What are the reasons for the mitzvot? There are basically four kinds of mitzvot. There are reflexive laws, which are laws to elevate the performer of the law, to make a person a better person. This law will make you a better person. For example, giving charity. Giving charity will hopefully make me a better person. Why? Make me a kinder person. When I give, I see the need in the other person. I feel like a better person. Hopefully it will elevate me into a higher level. So reflexive laws. Every act we perform has an impact on us. In fact, today that's part of psychology is behavior modification. You change the behavior, you change the patterns of the person's thinking. And today that's the only kind of thing which works with autistic children. The only thing which really works with autistic children is behavior modification. Just alter their behavior and you'll see certain changes in the way they think. If they just keep on behaving the same way, you allow them to behave in the same way, they're not going to change. If you change the way they behave, you'll see the change in the thinking patterns as well. So every Jewish law affects the performer. But there are certain Jewish laws whose purpose is almost exclusively to affect the performer. The most obvious example is prayer. A person prays, who am I praying to? What am I praying for? I'm praying to elevate myself to reach the level where I can talk to God. That's a very high level. So, litpalel, the word to pray, is in the reflexive. Lehitpalel, I'm praying for myself already. I'm elevating myself. I'm examining myself. God doesn't need our prayers. We need our prayers. We have to elevate ourselves. And I said before, is prayer and learning Torah is all these are reflexive, which are to elevate the performance of the law. There's laws of ethics. The ultimate purpose of all Jewish laws is to produce good people. So there's laws of ethics. There's hundreds of mitzvot, which are laws of ethics, like the last six of the Ten Commandments. Classics. Honoring your parents. That's ethics. Why ethics? I owe them a debt of gratitude. That itself is an ethical concept. To owe someone a debt of gratitude is an ethical concept. And the worst thing a Jew can be is an ingrate. One of the worst character traits a person can have is to be ungrateful. Someone did so much for you, and you come and you kick them in the face. That's why honoring one's parents is so important, because really, if you take that analogy further, how many people kick God in the face? I mean, God is our parent, celestial parent. And a person comes on and says, I deny God. I just don't believe in God. So like a person saying, you know, I deny my human creators. I deny my parents. I don't believe they didn't do anything for them. I hate my parents. How many people say today, I hate my parents? You know, in Jewish law, who is the person in Jewish law who should have the most rights to hate their parents? A mamzer. Mamzer is a person born from an adulterous relationship. He should hate his father. You, look what you did to me. I can't marry a Jew. I'm not allowed to marry a Jewish girl. What have you done to me? My reputation. And growing up, you know, mamzer, it's interesting. At a Brit Milah, we bless the child. May this child live. And may the parents see. Raise him for Torah, Chuppah, and Masim Tovim. To learn Torah, to have his wedding, and to do good deeds. For mamzer, we don't say that. We don't want the child to live. We don't pray for the child to live. You know what it's like to be a mamzer? Terrible. Today, forget about it. We're all mamzer. Every other guy around is mamzer. But, just exaggerating. But in those days, it was a tremendous, tremendous stigma. Tremendous stigma. Mamzer. And they knew about it. They knew this person had an adulterous relationship. Jewish law states a mamzer has to honor his parents. His real parents, biological parents. Oh God, that must be the hardest mitzvah in the world. For a mamzer to honor his parents. Why? Just appreciate that you were brought into the world. We don't know how much we owe their parents just for being born. But again, that's assuming birth is a good thing. So we're on the side of Beit Shammai. This is a Beit Hillel Beit Shammai debate. For 70 years they debated the question, is it good for a person to be born or not? And the bottom line they said is, you have to stay alive once you're born. It's a philosophical argument. Is it good for a person to be born or not? And they said, no, the chances are a person's not going to be good. If the chances are weighted against a person being good in this world, why be born? And they looked around and they said, statistics are, majority of people are not good. And therefore they said, why be born? They said, it's better for a person not to be born. But now that we're born, we should search our deeds very carefully. We want to be on the good part. The small minority of people in the world who are good and ethical and moral and decent people. So we have the laws of ethics. We have the laws of ethics, which the last six of the Ten Commandments: honor one's parents, not to murder, commit adultery, steal, bear false witness, or covet. And they have been adopted by nearly every civilization in the world. However, most of Judaism's other laws of ethics have not been adopted. For instance, there are many other laws of ethics. It's a mitzvah to give 10% of one's income to charity. And what's interesting is we were discussing this the other morning. We have a class, by the way, every morning on Mishnah. At 7:30 in the morning. And we were discussing this one of the mornings. And we said that today most people fulfill this mitzvah. They could fill it very easily. You pay a taxes, income tax. What a person should think when they're paying income tax is they are supporting social welfare programs. You're not paying for the United States Army or the Air Force or the bureaucracy. My money, when I pay my income tax, is going for social welfare programs, or it's going towards the $3 billion that goes to Israel every year. Not the $3 billion that goes to Egypt, but $3 billion that goes to... Right, another half million, oh God. So we can fulfill the mitzvah so I can very easily today. Because a person pays 28% of his income to Uncle Sam. If you can allocate, and in Jewish law you're allowed to allocate, you can say, this money is going towards this purpose. And this way you can fill your mitzvah, you can give even more than 10%. Because, I mean, the government is doing a lot of charity. I don't know how much of the GNP is going towards, very, very small. But in terms of the billions of dollars which are being spent on social welfare programs, a lot of money being spent. So my money, my income tax, is going to go towards the social welfare programs. This way I'm fulfilling my mitzvah of tzedakah. That's assuming the taxes are not for social welfare programs. Your tzedakah is, the purpose of tzedakah is to help the poor. If I am paying,
you give 10% off the top,
it depends on, again, it depends on whether your taxation, in those days, taxation never went to the social welfare programs. At the times when these laws were written, when you're talking about the laws were written, there was no such thing as social welfare programs. The only people in the world who had social welfare programs were Jews. There was no other concept. The Romans asked Rabbi Akiva, why do you want to give money to the poor? He said, what do you mean? He said, if God created them poor, God wanted them poor. God wanted them poor, you're defeating God's purpose by helping them. He said, no, the other way around. The reason why God created poor people is for me to help them. God wants me to help the poor. That's why he gave me poor people. It's the total opposite concept. Saddam was a classic example. They never helped the poor. Why? If God created the poor, that was their tough luck. Well, I'm creating rich. I don't have to look after them. The only nation in the world who gave poor charity, there's no such concept. Who invented the concept of charity? Tzedakah came from this Jewish concept. It's a Jewish concept. So when they talked about giving 10%, because in those days, you paid your taxes, what did it go for? It went to support the army of the king and support his palaces and who knows what else it supported. But it never went to social welfare. There's no such thing as social welfare programs. Yes? Right, because they're born like that, they deserved it. Right, they deserve it. Unfortunately, I read an article in Newsweek magazine they had on Russia. The orphanages, terrible, terrible. Look at the pictures of little kids. They tie them to their beds. And one of the nurses said, if they're born with these defects, God wanted it like that. That's their mission in life. So it's a terrible thing to say. That is not the Jewish concept. The Jewish concept is to rectify the world, to fix the world, to try and make the world a better place. And that's our mission. And without these things, we wouldn't have a mission. It gives us purpose. For those who have, they have a bigger purpose. They have a hefty purpose. So laws of ethics, whereas the last six commandments basically have been adopted by societies, other laws of ethics, like the 10% rule, have not been adopted. Although today we said with the welfare programs, a large amount of societies today are giving 10%. Maybe. So it's very important to define what goodness is. It's very easy to say, I'll be a good person. Most people think goodness is not doing bad. I didn't harm anyone, I'm a good person. Wrong. You're just not a bad person. But goodness is doing positive, something good positive. There's a mitzvah in the Torah that prohibits a Jew from asking a storekeeper the price of an item, for he knows he will not buy it. While you're raising the guy's hopes, and then when you walk out, you're dashing the hopes. You've got to tell the guy, I'm just inquiring. But if you see, there's hundreds of laws. Lashon hara. Gossip. I mean, it's such a hard mitzvah to keep. And it just permeates every facet of our lives. Because you can't talk. Who are you going to talk to? What are you going to talk about? I'll talk about this guy. I'll talk about that guy. What can I say about this guy? The Jew must feed his animals before he eats. The animals must rest on Shabbat. There's no eruv. You can imagine, the dog cannot walk around with a collar outside the doorway. He's carrying the collar on Shabbat. The dog is working on Shabbat. Where did you get these laws from? Ethical laws. We are not even permitted to be joyful over the downfall of our enemies. Our enemies fall. The Egyptians were killed. Thank God he's killed. Yeah. No. Half halal. Not a full halal. You're allowed to praise God fully. Half halal. The last 6 days of Pesach, it's half halal. We pour 10 drops of wine from our cup. What does that show? Our joy is not full. Every plague, one less wine, less wine, less wine. Less wine, we should pour more wine. It's even better, more plague, great, more wine. No, we take out the wine, yes.
I think the Egyptians were turned to an enemy, was different than that of
Obama. Well, they killed all the male boys. They killed, tried to kill all the male childs. Pharaoh passed the decree. He made all the Jews slaves. They had the first concentration camps in our history. Two women.
Yeah.
But again, maybe they were Jewish women. That's what the Midrash says. They were Jewish women. The Midrash says they were the mother and sister of Moses, Shifra and Pua. But that's debatable. But maybe that's what the Midrash says. Anyway, they're just giving an example of, you know, they were enemies, okay? They kept us as slaves for 210 years. We'll be allowed to hate them, no? Rejoice when they fall? No, don't rejoice when they fall. Right? We learn out from there that we're grateful to them. They looked after us. What do you mean they looked after us? Hey, 1 second. No, they let you be in their land for 210 years. That already is something big. You know, another nation would come along and boot them out straight away. I mean, they were good in the times of the famine. They looked after us because Joseph was the viceroy of Egypt. So what happens? So it is as difficult to become a good person as it is to become a good artist. Just like an artist. Some people are naturals. Same thing spiritually. There are people who are naturally good. I've seen them. I've had relatives who are naturally good people. But not everyone is a naturally good person. We all know ourselves. And we have to work at it. It's a hard thing. It's just like being a natural artist. Not everyone's a natural artist. Some people have to work at it. Not everyone's a natural mathematician. You've got to work at it. So therefore, same thing. Same thing with goodness. You have to work at goodness. So this is a system. It's like exercise. Everyone's a natural athlete. You've got to work at it. Most people are not natural. They may have a tendency to be athletic, but to be a really good athlete today, you've got to keep on training and training and training. Same thing spiritually. We've got to keep on training. So that's what these laws, ethical laws, are for. Train to be good. Laws of holiness. Judaism demands the Jews be a holy as well as a moral people. You should be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. What does that mean? Holiness. Human being is created in the image of God, but we are also created from the dust of the earth. So on both sides, we're created with the dust of the earth. We have the physical desires and tendencies. On the other hand, we have this holy spark in us, and we have to try and sanctify the animal-like instincts and make them holy. And that's why we have the large number of mitzvot to do with the basic physical needs of man. We can eat or do other things just like animals do, or we can elevate the way we engage in those activities. And so that's very important. To elevate the act of eating, Judaism prescribes numerous mitzvot, laws of kashrut. We're elevating the act of eating into a holy act. We're making this mundane. Just stand outside Charlie Brown and see how they go in, see how they come out. How do you elevate that into a holy act? People discuss, you know, the menu and this and that. I mean, I was at a wedding on Sunday. I mean, I've never seen so much food in my life. I can't believe how much people could even, you know, want to eat. I mean, just after you see so much food, you just get sick of the food. I mean, how much can a person eat in this world? I don't know. But Judaism is trying to elevate the act of eating. How do we do that? First, you wash hands, sign a blessing over the food, blessing after the food. The Rambam says a Jew should never eat till they're full. It's a tough one. That's one of the toughest things. Toughest Rambam's ever seen is, what do you mean? You're not allowed to eat until you're satiated. It's not healthy. He says, because of health reasons. Number one, we said, first priority is health. Be healthy to to be able to survive, to be able to teach more Torah and learn to more Torah. So he says, to be healthy, a Jew should never be eat till they're full. Why? He said, most sicknesses are caused by overeating. I don't know how much after it is, but a lot of sicknesses are caused just by the act of overeating. So again, it's hard, but it's holiness. It's sanctifying the act of eating. That's when the kashrut comes in, sanctifying the act of eating. Similarly, in terms of sexual activities, Judaism tries to make them holy, what is naturally animal-like. The Ten Commandments outlaws adultery. Even within marriage, Jewish law has stiff rules and regulations. It's hard to imagine